World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation in behalf of distributors and dealers all over America and in many foreign lands. By shortwave broadcast direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers of our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Douglas Edwards.
Allied headquarters announced today that elements of 14 German divisions and parts of four others have been caught in the Normandy pockets and are being blasted to pieces by artillery fire. The Germans say American forces have crossed the Seine, northwest of Paris. In the south, the 7th Army has sealed the doom of Toulon and Marseille by a 20-mile advance toward the Rhone Valley. On the eastern front, the Red Army is hammering at four salients as the Germans report a new attack in the south. Here at home, Russian Ambassador Gromyko has arrived in Washington for the world security talks. And the War Department announces another raid by the B-29 superplanes on industrial areas in the vicinity of Yawata on Kyushu Island on the Japanese homeland. And now for our first news direct from overseas, Admiral takes you to London, Richard C. Hottolett reporting.
The Germans this evening report that American tanks are across the Seine River after airborne and parachute troops had established a bridgehead somewhere between Vernon and Mantes. The enemy says that heavy fighting is in progress at this point. There is no confirmation in London, and there isn't likely to be under the present policy of secrecy, but a delayed report from this part of the front this evening makes the German story sound logical. A writer correspondent said that American forces were stretched out along the west bank of the river for miles north of Mantes. Standing on a bit of high ground, he said he could see the river's great loop bend, and our air forces harassing the fleeing enemy on the roads leading to the river, on barges as he tried to get across, and on the roads on the other side. This part of the Seine is a logical place for a crossing because of the great loop that juts eastward deep into enemy territory. We'll have to wait for official confirmation before we base too many hopes on the German report. The writer correspondent goes on to say that General Patton's forces had reached the Seine here to cut the escape route of the Germans fleeing eastward toward the river from the Falaise trap. And it looks more as if General Eisenhower's immediate intention is to complete the destruction of von Kluge's 7th Army. Already, the Falaise trap is being liquidated. It was revealed in London this evening that the pocket contains the bulk of the combat elements of 14 divisions and parts of four other divisions. There's no more German resistance anywhere west of the town of Côté, and Allied forces are meeting up and down the line. British troops join the Americans in Argentan today. But the Germans are still fighting in a smaller pocket between Côté and Chambois. There's no sign of mass surrender, and although the British took something like 1,000 prisoners today, the Germans still seem to have some striking power left. They're still trying to fight their way out of the encirclement to safety. They withdrew as much as they possibly could from the western part of the pocket and grouped it eastward into a striking force. With this, they've been fighting their way northeastward between Troyes and Chambois. Tonight, it was stated in London that they had made slight progress. But German losses have been heavy. Guns, tanks, and transport have been abandoned in bulk. One group of 1,000 vehicles jammed together was found in the Gouffin forest north of Argentan. Still, it appears that some enemy troops are already getting away. They're reported to be crossing the Seine in fairly considerable numbers at between 12 and 20 organized crossing points downstream from Vernon. They're using barges, pontoons, and anything they can lay their hands on. At one point, they're said to be swimming the river. Luckily for them, the weather hasn't been very good again today, but even so, our low-flying fighters and fighter bombers have been harassing the enemy. Up on the northern flank of the Normandy front, Canadian forces have been pushing along the coastline. But they've also been sending an arm out toward Lisieux to help cut off the German retreat. There, they're within 7.5 miles of the town and have captured the hamlet of Livarot. There's no more word from the eastern flank of the French front, the one that runs north from Orléans. The Germans report us at various places in relation to Paris and have even floated a trial balloon through neutral correspondents in Berlin to the effect that American columns have entered the French capital. This is probably as much to whip up false hopes on our part as it is to get some information as to where we really are. As far as we can judge from London, it looks more as if we were out to wipe out the rest of the German forces within reach rather than rush into Paris. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
And now for a summary of the fighting in southern France and an interview with two American lieutenants from Chicago, Admiral takes you to CBS Rome, Winston Burdett reporting.
Our troops in southern France today are circling far inland, into the fastnesses of the Maritime Alps to the northeast, around Toulon and on toward Marseille to the west. A spectacular advance has carried them onto the heights above the Durance River, a main tributary of the Rhone. Before them, the highways of southern France branch out to Aix, to Marseille, to Avignon. And still, there is no first-class enemy opposition in sight. What resistance there is on the coast around Toulon, we are merely sidestepping, and already our flying columns are well to the north of Marseille. At the other end of the invasion front, we are now well into the Maritime Alps, and at last report, we're still moving fast. There are probably very few Germans up in that spur mountainous country, which in peacetime was familiar to thinkers and seers, but which today belongs to the French partisans. Whether the 7th Army is going to head straight for Marseille, we don't know. We are streaming now from the beachhead in many directions, and there is no hint of where the main drive will aim. It may take a surprising turn. Our banners are going out ahead of us every day to pound bridges and roads and viaducts up and down the Rhone Valley. The most spectacular raid last week was the one on Friday on the former French warships in Toulon Harbor. Spectacular because the flak was the heaviest our raiders have encountered in many weeks, and because, despite that, bomb photo interpreters gave it a rating of 100% for accuracy. Here in the studio is the pilot of the lead ship of one of the B-25 Mitchell formations that hit Toulon, and his bombardier. The pilot is Lieutenant Frank M. Fury, the bombardier, Lieutenant Robert W. Joyce. They both hail from Chicago, Illinois.
And we have quite a rough ride, Frank.
We certainly did. The sky over Toulon was black with flags, big dancing circles. I happened to look up twice during the bomb run, and there were clouds of black smoke ahead of us. We rode right through them. Another time, just 20 seconds before the bombs were away, a shell exploded under us and jolted the plane off to the right. But I kicked the controls back, and we got back onto our course on time. And I understand you hit those bits. Yes, but Bob here had as much to do with that as I did. How was the bombing, Bob?
Well, it had to be good, because our formation fell with its bombs off the lead ship, and our ship was leading. The target, as you know, was a French warship that the Germans had been using to sell our troops coming over from the depot. The four of them, a battleship, a cruiser, a destroyer, and a submarine, were lined up the entrance of the inner fort. Our bombs went right down the middle and hit all four. Frank here was hit by flak while flying the bomber.
Badly hit, Frank?
Just a scratch. Bob was hit, too. As a matter of fact, four of us were. Our navigator got a piece of flak in his shoulder, and my co-pilot, the commander of our group, was also hit by a piece that came flying through the cockpit and just missed my head. It was really a miracle that we got out of it so well. The Jerrys had our course and had our altitude. They put 23 holes in the nose of our plane, another 25 in the wings and fuselage. They put holes in 3/4 of the B-25 Mitchell that took part in that raid, but they didn't bring a single one of us down. Could you see your bomb strike, Bob?
No, I couldn't.
As soon as our bombs were away, I had to go back to give first aid to our group commander. He was rather badly hurt in the arm. But during the run, I could see the guns flashing from the French battleship, a blanket of fast bursting below. They dragged us all the way in, followed us all the way out again to sea. But I'm told we did the job. We completely wrecked at least one big turret with dual guns, 13 inches, and that battleship.
Thanks a lot, Bob and Frank. This is Winston Burdett in Rome, returning you now to Admiral in New York.
More news in just a moment, but first here's Warren Sweeney with a message from Admiral Corporation.
When you're entertaining, do you ever have enough ice cubes to last out the evening? No doubt friend husband has often had to make a special trip to the corner or over to the ice plant to get those extra ice cubes that you must have. Well, when victory has been won and you own an Admiral 2-temperature refrigerator, your ice cube worries will be over. For you can freeze a whole bushel of them, 400 ice cubes at almost unbelievable speed. And you can store them in the built-in home freezer so they'll be always available. And the dry cold prevents them from sticking together so that you can get just the number you want without having to break them apart. Of course, the primary purpose of the built-in home freezer in the Admiral 2 temperature is the quick freezing and storing of frozen foods. Its ample capacity permits the storage of 2 bushels of frozen foods. And it's easy to see how it will simplify your meal planning problems with a variety of frozen food always at hand. Add to this the features of Sterilamp for killing bacteria and retarding mold, no defrosting, no covered dishes, and you can understand why the Admiral 2 temperature will be just as popular as its famous companion product, Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Now here once again is Douglas Edwards.
Columbia's shortwave listening station here in New York heard a British broadcast report that General de Gaulle, accompanied by General Alphonse Juin, has arrived in Cherbourg. There have been reports during the week that de Gaulle would join the first American forces to enter Paris. The Russians are driving hard today to outflank Warsaw from the north. Bitter fighting is going on near Praga, only 7 miles northeast of the Polish capital, where the Red Army now has the initiative. Premier Stalin, in a special order of the day honoring the Soviet Air Force, has announced that Russian airmen now have complete domination in the air over Germany. He said Russian flyers have destroyed 50,000 enemy planes since the war began. And now here in our New York studio to discuss with you the situation on the Eastern Front is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
The Germans appear to be stiffening their defense all along the Russian front from the Gulf of Riga down to the Middle Vistula. A powerful German counterattack has been launched against the railway junction of Sholye, with the probable intention of checking the Russian encircling movement swinging down toward the Niemen River and the northeastern frontier of East Prussia. This attack also tends to draw off some of the reserves of General Chernyakhovsky's army group from the direct attack on East Prussia from the eastward, where the Russians have reached, but not so far as has been reported, crossed the German frontier. There seems no doubt that the Germans are prepared to make a desperate defense of East Prussia and are almost fanatically resolved, come what may, to prevent, if they can, an actual invasion of what they call holy German soil. In the vicinity of Warsaw, repeated German counterattacks have so far checked Russian attempts to fight their way into Praga, the east bank suburb of the Polish capital. While within Warsaw itself, the Polish underground forces are still maintaining some of their positions against heavy German assaults, aided to some extent by supplies dropped by British airmen. Farther south, the Russians are making their only real gains of the moment. They have taken the historic town of Sandomierz, perched high on the western bank of the Vistula at the junction of the River Son. This has enabled them to widen considerably the shoulders of their penetration beyond the Vistula and to encircle a group of 3 German divisions which was engaged in counterattack against this Russian bridgehead. The Russians are now resuming their efforts in the direction of the important road center of Kielce. If Kielce falls, the threat to the German positions around Warsaw will be considerable, as the German forces in the vicinity of the capital will be in danger of being outflanked from the south. Perhaps the most notable feature of the fighting on the Eastern Front during the past month has been the stiffening of the German resistance all along the line after the tremendous Russian victory in White Russia during the last week of June and the steady Russian advances during most of July, advances which toppled stronghold after stronghold, cut off a whole German army group in the Baltic states, and brought the Russians to the borders of East Prussia, to the gates of Warsaw, and to the line of the Vistula River, south of Warsaw. Along this line, the Germans managed to stabilize the front, and there it has remained more or less stabilized ever since. The Russians have, however, now had time to reorganize their supply system and to regroup their forces, and it seems altogether likely that the last days of August and the month of September will see decisive battles on a grand scale all along this long eastern front. Now here again is Douglas Edwards.
All Spain is watching the progress of the Allied drives in northern and southern France. For a direct report on news from occupied Europe and the battlefronts reaching Spain, Admiral takes you to CBS Madrid. Glenn Stadler reporting.
Just a little more than 4 years ago, on June 14, 1940, Paris was a beaten, lifeless, and lightless city. I was one of the few American correspondents there that fateful day. And now that our own troops are virtually at its gate, it seems appropriate to recall scenes of the Wehrmacht entrance. Then the Nazi victory trumpets glistened in the hot sunshine. Now, rusty, battered, and long unused, they're being dragged back toward a crumbling fatherland. The afternoon of June 13th was a fitting prelude to tomorrow. A flaming oil depot, apparently in the same locality as the one burning just outside of Paris this afternoon, poured forth immense clouds of smoke. Rain fell through it, speckling black everything it touched. Beneath this sinister omen, refugees struggled southward. The impression was one of unreality, like a nightmare in which it's impossible to frisk to flee from a horrible monster. Later, the sun came out, and the red panorama it created in the sky blended with the spices from hundreds of German guns not far away. There was one enormous explosion that took all of Paris. That was the last bridge the French blew up. Inside the city, which that morning had been declared an open city, there was no destruction whatsoever. At midnight, the shooting had ceased. The Champs-Élysées was deserted. The sound of footsteps echoed as if in a tomb. Every one of the less than a million who remained knew that Hitler's mechanized giants would swim in within a few hours. Some believed Dragon could set the Germans to the south. That within a week, Hitler was treading around Marshal Foch's railway coach in Compiègne Forest, dictating armistice terms. At dawn, the Germans entered. Swastikas were hoisted over Napoleon's Arc de Triomphe and over the Eiffel Tower. Hundreds of tricolors were torn down and left crumpled in the dirt. Soon, General von Studenitz arrived and established headquarters in the Crillon Hotel, just across from the American Embassy, with one effect that he'd be the first German general in Paris. Most of the French remained indoors, but those who did venture out stood around in apathetic little groups. They were stunned, bewildered, helpless. Yes, and hopeless. What had happened to the French army that everyone thought was the best in the world? Another correspondent and I rode bicycles over Frenzard Bridge, which was heavily guarded with anti-tank guns. We passed the German embassy on Rue de Lille just in time to see its doors creak open. The air was filled with the odor of mothballs. A few days later, Otto Abetz, the Nazi who earlier had been expelled from France, arrived to take over as ambassador. Today, this very same Otto Abetz has skipped out of Paris to avoid capture by Allied forces. Also reported as having left is DC French Premier Laval, the man Abetz often described as the only Frenchman who can guarantee collaboration with Hitler. All that day, the conquering German armies rolled in, converging at Place Le Concorde. Bands flared out Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles, and goose-stepping soldiers shouted themselves forth with feet high, hail victory. The following bell's whistling sound mingled with the triumphant noise of the Wehrmacht. It was the sound of French soldiers, dirty, analyzed, and utterly defeated. They were on their way to long years in Nazi prison. But today, August 20th, 1944, their fearful dark vigil is about finished, for the armies of liberation are on the march to Berlin. This is Ben Sadler in Madrid, returning you to Admiral in New York.
Admiral takes you now to CBS Washington. Don Pryor reporting.
I want you to meet Lieutenant Commander C.R. Conger, USNR, a man who probably knows as much as anybody about amphibious warfare. He trained the naval beach parties for North Africa, Sicily, Italy, Normandy, and the Pacific. And he's just come back from a flying trip to Guam, where he went in with the invasion force. First of all, Pete, what is a beach party and what does it do?
It's a small unit of officers and men, all of them specially picked for their drive and initiative. They're the connecting link between the Navy afloat and the Army and Marines ashore. They live in organized confusion, and they have to be the bosses of it, because there can't be any red tape on a beachhead. Things just have to get done.
Well, but just what do they do? Are they traffic cops, more or less?
Yes, and a lot more. One of the officers is a doctor, and he has 8 medical corpsmen with him. He goes in with one of the early waves just as soon as he can get ashore and sets up a first aid and evacuation station. It's usually in a foxhole or dugout covered with a tent or palmetto leaves. In most landings, the flood of wounded starts almost immediately. As soon as the corpsmen round them up and bring them in, And the doctor, usually a young guy, works day or night to get the job done. So do the corpsmen. Some of these men have been through as many as 5 different landings.
Well, what about the rest of the outfit?
Well, there's a hydrographic and a boat repair section. They reconnoiter the beach, clear away any obstacles they can, set up identification markers for landing craft, salvage and repair boats, and check casualties, and generally work like fools. Then there's a communication unit. Their job is to establish communication between the beaches and the ships offshore. Actually, that's just the beginning. On any landing beach, you'll find the beach party men doing 1,000 different jobs. They direct traffic, help unload ships, help with the wounded, fight off counterattacks, and use every means and short of mayhem to keep things moving. They're the expediters of the beachhead.
Well, where do you get men like that?
That's hard to answer. You've seen men like them on construction jobs. Men who believe in what they're doing and believe in themselves so thoroughly that nothing can stop them. They get the job done regardless of who or what gets in their way. They're not always big men or fine physical specimens. In fact, you'll find tiny little men wading in through the surf towards the enemy beach with a tremendous load on his back. Now, that'll be a beach party man.
Well, they must be pretty well trained, Pete.
Yes, they are. If you hike 5 or 10 miles every day for a while with a full pack on your back, work for hours and water up to your waist, in the meantime sleep in the open and eat cold food, you're bound to get tough if you can take it. These men are the ones who could take it. Most of them are young, but youth isn't necessary. We have a man out there, a commander, who's a group beachmaster, who's a good example. They call him Squeaky Anderson. Before the war, he was a big salmon fisherman in Alaska. He's about 56 years old, but he has more stamina, drive, and determination than almost any other 2 men. He's a real character. You'll find him out there running around an old Sherlock Holmes hat with a pair of green shorts, working like a fool day and night, and getting everybody else to work the same way.
Well, it's men like that, I guess, who make this country what it is. And I guess it's men like that whose country this ought to be. The latest news here in Washington is that Soviet Ambassador Gromyko, who's chairman of Russia's delegation to the 4-Power World Peace Organization Conference, which opens tomorrow, arrived from Moscow a couple of hours ago in a big Soviet transport plane. That completes the roster for the opening talks between Russia, Britain, and the United States. China will be brought in later, when conferences with Russia have been completed. Donald Nelson, War Production Chief, and Major General Patrick Hurley are being sent to China by President Roosevelt, supposedly to lay the economic groundwork for intensification of the war against Japan. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
In the Southwest Pacific, the bombing of a 1,500-ton Japanese freighter transport, which was left sinking off Davao, the second largest city of the Philippines, was announced in a headquarters communique today, which also revealed that Allied patrol planes now have the island of Mindanao, the largest of the Philippines, under constant surveillance. And now once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral.
We know that many of our listeners plan to build a new home or remodel their present ones when the war is won. In most cases, this will include new furniture. Well, there'll be an Admiral radio in a superbly styled cabinet to complement the decorative plan you have in mind. Admiral will keep up its tradition of fine cabinets to add grace and charm to any surroundings. If it's period designs you want, Admiral will have them. If your choice runs to the more modern, there'll be an Admiral to suit your taste. And you can be assured of getting enduring construction as well as matchless beauty. For the cabinet that is an exquisite piece of furniture, plus the fine reception of Admiral radio, plus the complete dependability and simplicity of the Admiral automatic record changer, you can't do better than Admiral. And they are built for the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. If the farmers of America are to meet the huge production goals for this year, they must have part-time help from millions of people who haven't previously done farm work. All types of laborers are wanted, men and women, boys and girls, no matter where you live. Prevailing wages will be paid, whether it's for a few days or a few weeks. Be part of the U.S. Crop Corps. America needs your help. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set, and post-war makers of Admiral Refrigerators, Admiral Home Freezers, Admiral Electric Ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
WBBM, Chicago.